To order. Our first item on the agenda are confirmations to the Board of Judicial Standards. So we have Timothy Gephardt and William Worms. Take them one at a time. Mr. Gephardt, why don't you come on forward? You're first for some reason on the agenda here, so maybe it's alphabetical. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Members, there are biographies and information to the individuals here already in your packet, so go ahead and take a look.
Mr. Gephardt, tell us why we should confirm you.
Well, I've got a good deal of experience in dealing with legal malpractice and lawyer discipline systems, and I think the experience I've got in those two fields lends a good deal of credibility to my work with the judges.
Mr. Gephardt, how long have you served? By the way, both these confirmees have already been serving on the Board of Judicial Standards by appointment, pending confirmation by the Senate. So, sir, how long have you been on the board then?
Since July, last July.
Why don't you tell us a bit about your experience prior to being appointed to the board?
It's been a learning experience so far. I've been trying to get my feet on the ground. I'm sucking in a lot of information. We have, I've been appointed to the administrative committee, and I've been working on some improvements to the board's websites. Over the last few months that I've been on, we're working on revising the board's websites to make it a little bit easier for people to navigate to get more information out to the public. We go through issues each month. We meet each month and go through complaints that are filed and get a chance to deliberate on those complaints. So it's been pretty much of a learning experience this first 6 months or so.
You were with Minnesota Lawyers Mutual since 1985?
Yes.
Did you practice before that time anywhere?
I'm a public member. I'm not a lawyer.
Oh, I see. Okay. So you've been quite active on ethics committees and professional responsibility activities and so on.
Yes.
Senator Latz?
Senator Sharon.
May I ask Mr. Gephardt if he would talk about, I'm sure you already know the answers to these questions, but for me it would be helpful if you would talk a little bit about what being on this board requires of you and what the scope of the board is that you bring your expertise to, so that I have a foundation to understand that.
Mr. Gephardt?
The board reviews complaints that are filed against judges. So each month we review a set of complaints that come in and determine whether or not to proceed with any kind of disciplinary action. That's the basic work of the board.
Senator Latz?
Senator Sharon.
And so what is the specific responsibility of a public member in that process?
The responsibilities are, I guess, to protect the public, first of all, to make sure that the discipline system discipline judges that deserve to be disciplined, and that discipline isn't doled out to judges who haven't done anything that doesn't require discipline under the code of judicial conduct.
And one more follow-up. And do you think that, I think it's one of the things that I admire about this process, as well as the Professional Board of Responsibility for Lawyers, is that public members participate in the process. It isn't simply judges or lawyers. Lawyers and judges invite public members to be a part of this process of reviewing complaints. And so, since you are a public member, correct?
Yes.
You're representing a public member. You're bringing something that is valued to the board because of the nature of your being a public member. Can you talk a little bit about what that is, what you think you uniquely bring because of being a public member?
Well, I think that I have a little bit different perspective than someone who's actually involved in the profession. I deal with lawyers every day in my work. either defending them and their legal malpractice claims that are brought against them, or taking care of the clients that may have been damaged by the negligence of a lawyer where they've been damaged. So coming at this job, I'm looking at it from a little bit different perspective than someone who's a judge, someone who's a lawyer. I don't have to appear in front of any of these judges. I'm not beholden to any of them. And I think that makes a difference. I'm looking at it from the perspective of someone whose very important matters might be in the hands of that judge someday.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Gephardt? Mr. Gephardt, have the members had a chance to look through the materials that are in the packet? I'll note that we do have a quorum here. Well, Mr. Gephardt, I first want to thank you for all of your public service. I'm looking through the activities that are on your resume. Could have just focused on your work at MLM. You've obviously chosen to be involved in lots of other capacities to improve the practice of law and the judiciary, and particularly to improve the experience of consumers, clients, as they appear in the legal system. So thank you for that. Is there any motion? Senator Sharon moves that the Senate Judiciary Committee recommend the confirmation of Timothy Gephardt for service on the Board of Judicial Standards. Is there any further discussion on that motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Gephardt, thank you for your time. Congratulations. This will now move to the Senate floor for final action. Mr. Werns. Mr. Worms, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon.
I'll ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Gephardt. What recommends you for confirmation to the Board of Judicial Standards?
Well, I'll answer in two parts. I was appointed to the board in June of 2011, and so I've served for over a year and a half at this point. And I've been privileged to serve with a very able and dedicated and congenial group of board members. And for that, I'm grateful. And I think during that time, we as a board have accomplished a number of things, and I've played a role in all of these. One of them would be that we have enhanced the openness of the board, the visibility to the public, to the legal profession, and to judges of what we do and why we do it. For example, we codified our policies and procedures and posted them on our website, so that people can see how we operate. We posted on our website all of the Minnesota Supreme Court public discipline opinions of judges over the years. We posted advisory opinion summaries on our website. Our annual reports are quite a bit beefier than they were before and give more information. We invited members of this committee and of the House committee to attend at one of our board meetings and meet with us for any questions that they might have about us. So we have, in many ways, enhanced our openness. There are a number of other accomplishments I won't go into unless somebody wants more information about the board. But as for myself, I have, as I say, served on the board for over a year and a half. I've served in the area of professional ethics, the ethics of the legal profession, since 1981 now, over 30 years. I was director of the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility for 7 years. I did lawyer discipline during that era. And I have also advised lawyers and a few judges. At last year's hearing, a great deal was made of this, and I went back and looked at my time records. That is, the question was, how could somebody who represented judges then police judges? And I put in something like 50 or 70 hours in my 31 years representing judges, and then another 70 hours representing Judge Burke in a matter that was discussed last year. So I wanted to put that in the right perspective. I'm the author of a number of works on legal ethics, including Minnesota Legal Ethics, which the State Bar hosts and which is an 800-page commentary on the Minnesota Rules of Professional Conduct for lawyers. This has been my life's work, and I see the board as an extension, part and parcel of my life's work and service to the public and to the profession of lawyering.
Thank you, Mr. Warnes. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Senator Sharon.
I don't know if I have to disclose this or not, but I did serve on the Lawyers Professional Board of Responsibility during the time that Mr. Wiss was the director of the Minnesota Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility. So I don't think that that creates a problem for me, excepting that I can assure the members of this committee that this is a very good appointment and that that you can support this recommendation without concern, without regard to any difficulties.
Senator Sharon. Any other questions or comments? Senator Sharon moves. Comfortable?
Yes.
Motion, Senator?
Absolutely. It's an honor.
Association, not a present. Senator Sharon moves that the Judiciary Committee recommend the confirmation of the appointment of William Warnes to the Board of Judicial Standards. Any further discussion? Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Warnes, congratulations.
Thank you, Senator.
Next up is the Senate floor. Senator Pappas. Welcome to the committee. Senate File 384, Safe Harbor for Sexually Exploited Youth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. The first thing I'd like to do is I have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, which deletes the entire Article 3.
Senator Pappas, is this your first stop? This is
my first stop, yep.
It's, the amendment is in your packets, members. Is that what it does? It deletes Section 3? It
deletes Article 3.
All right, there's an author's amendment. Practice is to go ahead and put the bill in the shape the author desires. All those, Senator Goodwin moves the author's amendment on behalf of Senator Pappas.
Well, I sure do.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have just a brief, some brief overview background comments, and then Ms. McKenzie is going to just do a brief overview of the bill, and then we'll zero in on what is before your jurisdiction.
Okay. McKenzie, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members, in 2011, Minnesota passed the Safe Harbor for Sexually Exploited Youth Act. The Safe Harbor's implementation was deferred until 2014 to give Minnesota time to build the system we need to effectively address the problem of child sex trafficking. Senate File 384 and the No Wrong Door Report, which is included in your committee materials, are the products of 18 months of hard work on the part of service providers, law enforcement professionals, philanthropy, advocates, and survivors of sex trafficking from around the state, with coordination and input from the Departments of Public Safety, Health, Human Services, and generous financial support of the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. This plan represents the best practices from around our state and around the country that are resulting in convictions of those who engage in child sex trafficking and a chance for the victims of these crimes to rebuild their lives. What the bill does is it puts in place a statewide system of safe and secure shelter, trauma-informed care and services, comprehensive training for law enforcement and others to effectively identify victims and to aggressively investigate and prosecute cases of child sex trafficking. It is evidence-based, it's trauma-informed, and a model that holds the perpetrators of child sex trafficking accountable for their crimes. Stopping the trafficking of our children is not only a moral imperative, but also a sound investment for the state of Minnesota. A 2012 cost-benefit study, also included in your committee materials, conducted by the University of Minnesota and Indiana State University, showed a savings of 34 state tax dollars for every dollar invested in a model like the Safe Harbor No Wrong Door model. With that, Madam Chair and members, I'll introduce Ms. McKenzie, who will just explain what's left of the bill.
Thank you. My name is Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michelle Garnett McKenzie. I'm at the Advocates for Human Rights and am delighted to be here. Thank you for taking time to hear this bill and what I know is a very busy schedule you have. And thank you to Senator Pappas for being a champion of this issue for many years and moving this forward. This bill completes work that was begun with the Safe Harbor for Sexually Exploited Youth Act of 2011, and it's what was contemplated at that time. It creates that system that's needed to effectively respond to child sex trafficking. It makes it possible to respond to prostituted children as the victims of the felonies they are, rather than with the ineffective approach of juvenile delinquency proceedings on misdemeanor charges. I'll give you a quick overview of the bill in its entirety. Article 1 creates one statewide director position and six grant-funded regional navigators. Those positions would be housed within the Minnesota Department of Health, and they fit the pieces of Minnesota's law enforcement and service provider resources that exist already together into a whole and support the issues of victim identification, effective law enforcement and referral for services, investigation and prosecution of these cases, of crimes of trafficking. These are complex crimes. They're multi-jurisdictional, and we have some really expert law enforcement growing here in the state. It needs to be supported and brought statewide. This also, Article 1, will require some evaluation. This is a new approach to our law enforcement and delinquency, and we want to make sure that it remains an evidence-based approach. Article 2, which is really before this committee, removes all prostituted children under 18 from the delinquency jurisdiction. It makes sure that all sexually exploited youth are treated as such, as the crime victims they are, and repeals a diversion program for 16 and 17-year-olds that was created in 2011 before we really had the services and system built out the way we do now. And now that we do have these evidence-based programs identified in the No Wrong Door approach, we are ready to meet the victims' needs, make sure they're not just simply decriminalized without being able to follow up and effectively move them into the services and housing they need to get off the street and rebuild their lives. Now, this Article 2 really does reflect Minnesota's longstanding view that prostitution of children is a serious crime. It is a felony in the state to pay for sex with anyone under 18, and this treats these victims as the victims they are. Article 4 allocates funding to MDH and to the Department of Health and Human Services for the specialized housing, treatment, and services for the victims that are needed. Sexually exploited children really face complex challenges. They can suffer frequently traumatic brain injury, other trauma, physical injuries resulting from repeated multiple rape. Of course, they are subject to the psychological control tactics of their traffickers that can be very difficult to break. And the shame and stigma that surrounds prostitution is something that affects them not only in return to families and communities, but also even in working through mainstream service providers. So this bill would provide the specialized services and housing to make sure that we can meet those kids where they are with what they need and what's proven to be effective. We have learned so much since 2011. When this took off, the Safe Harbor Working Group's 18-month process has yielded this No Wrong Door model that is ready to meet the kids' needs, to make sure that we are not leaving them without a response, and to make sure that all of Minnesota's sexually exploited children get the services and housing and help that they need. With that,
Mr. Chairman, next I'd like to introduce John Choi, the Ramsey County Attorney.
Mr. Choi, welcome to the committee. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it's great to be here, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Choi, the Ramsey County Attorney. I've been working on this issue of sex trafficking since I've become the Ramsey County Attorney, and I want to say first off that I really believe that this issue of children being sold in our community is really one of the greatest human rights atrocities that's happening right before our eyes. In 2012 alone, in the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, we prosecuted 12 cases involving child victims. And I can tell you that each one of these victims, these children who are being sold in our community, They are not delinquents. They are not criminals. They are really victims of crime. They are coerced, threatened, physically beaten, and forced to commit to be essentially raped by people in our community. And so this is a huge, growing problem. And what concerns me most is that I see these victims getting younger and younger. In fact, the average age of entry into prostitution is 13 years of age. And that's a very astonishing number, but that is really what's happening in our community. In order to address this horrible crime in our community, I really believe a victim-centered approach is one that we as a state should be embracing. And this bill that is before you today, Senate File 384, does that. And there's a provision in this bill specifically that's before this committee relative to whether or not 16- and 17-year-olds should be treated as delinquents. In February of 2011, the county attorneys in the metropolitan area announced that we would no longer prosecute these children and treat them as victims of crime and children in need of protection, and that's what they are. And when we do that, we have had great results in Ramsey County when law enforcement, when they arrive at the situation and start dealing with these young children as victims and start reinforcing that the system, the police and the prosecution want to help you, what ends up happening is that these children start trusting and believing that the people in the system do care, and then they are more apt to want to testify against the people that have been trafficking against them. To get children to do that is immensely challenging, but we have had positive results because of the victim-centered approach that we use in Ramsey County. Just as an example, there was a case at the Days Inn in Roseville, and because of the Roseville Police Department's approach to dealing with this victim, this young 17-year-old girl, let's make also no mistake, these victims are not just from urban communities. They are from all over the state of Minnesota. This 17-year-old girl from greater Minnesota, because of that approach, was ready, willing, and able to testify against this very bad man named Samuel Cozart. And because of her willingness to testify, he pled guilty, and he's serving a 21-year sentence, which is the longest sentence that I'm aware of for a sex trafficking case. But that case would not have happened if that 17-year-old girl was not willing and ready to testify, and she was because of the fact that by the time we got to trial, she trusted a police officer named Ben more than she trusted this trafficker named Samuel Cozart. And I really believe it starts with getting it right with respect to how we treat these children. And again, these children are not delinquents. They are not criminals. They are children in need of protection. This is not a choice that these children make, but it is something that is forced upon them through threats of violence and coercion. The whole situation with respect to this is, you know, you've got vulnerable children who are typically runaways, and they're being exploited. So with that, members, I would just encourage you to support this bill, and I want to thank especially Senator Pappas for her really just longstanding leadership around this issue here.
Mr. Chairman, then finally we have Sergeant Grant Snyder from the Minneapolis Police Department.
Sergeant Snyder, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate being here today. You know, I've been working in sex trafficking for the better part of 13 years, from the initial days as a vice cop in the streets of North Minneapolis. And the lessons that I've learned have taught me a lot about how we work these cases and how we identify and service our victims. One of the biggest things that I've learned is that this fight is really about removing encumbrances. Sometimes those encumbrances are ones that we carry with us in terms of biases as an investigator, as a community. Sometimes they're biases in the law. And my experience has shown that our victims, our juvenile victims under 18 years old, it's all about breaking down the experience of victimization for them so that I can get them to trust them, like my colleague, Mr. Choi, just referred to. Developing that rapport. In an initial interview with the victim, whether they're 16, whether they're 17, whether they're 14, it's going to sound very different than an interview I would have with the victim of another crime. What I'm trying to do in that is get them to recognize that I may be the first person in their life that's not asking for something in return, that's only concerned about their welfare. And we use words like victim-centered approach, and lately I've kind of refined that to be to refer to more of a victim-partnered approach, because to me that's really what it feels like. And if I'm asking this juvenile victim to participate and do probably the scariest and most difficult thing that they've had to do to this point and ask to stand up and tell what happened to them, I need to know that legally I'm able to tell them honestly that you're not culpable, you're not in trouble for what happened in there, in that room, or in that series of hotel rooms where you've been kept for the last several months. I need to be able to express to them, we really are on your side, and it goes beyond just my office as a police detective, and it goes into the prosecutors, and it goes into us as a community. In talking with them, being able to remove that encumbrance of that threat of legal reprisal and legal sanction for what they did, when we can get beyond that, when we can finally let them know that we're on their side, that we recognize what they've been through, that makes a big difference in my ability to get us to the next step, and that's just to get them to talk about it. I can tell you one little girl that we rescued, and over a period of approximately 45 days, I rescued her three different times, and she was 17 years old. She was a little girl from northern Minnesota that came to the streets of Minneapolis with nothing but the clothes on her back. And she was victimized, and she was trafficked, and some of the situations she walked into were situations that she should have known better. But the reality was I would have not gotten to the point where she is today, and she's healthy, she's 18, she's been through treatment, and she's out teaching other kids how they can avoid the pitfalls of trafficking. We wouldn't have had that experience with her, but for my ability to say to her, we're not going to prosecute you for what happened. You're not going to be held responsible for the fact that you were in that room.
Mr. Chairman, then we're just open for questions from the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pappas, or one of your testifiers, I would assume. I have a question. Are all child prostitutes victims? Are there any that are criminals? I guess I'll start with that.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Snyder.
Mr. Chair, Senator, thank you for the question. You know, from my perspective as a detective, I've never met a child under the age of 18 years old that was not a victim of sex trafficking. In that arrangement, in that prostitution environment, there's always a suspect. There's always a person that's a trafficker there. And whether or not that individual, that child, is in that room because they put an ad on Backpage and had somebody rent a room for them and went there, there are always a series of coercive situations. I've talked to literally hundreds of girls, and over the course of my time, I've had them tell me all the same three things, and that is, I hate what I'm doing, it makes me feel terrible, and I'm only doing it for the money. Now, when everybody tells me the same three things, I believe that that's probably true. I've never found one that I felt had the ability to make that choice in any meaningful way to choose whether or not she was going to be there. And if somebody's purchasing her, there is a suspect, there is a trafficker in that relationship.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
I would assume that just because they turn 18 doesn't make them a criminal necessarily either. Many times they're still victims. I just kind of wondered that, you know, I'm hearing your testimony, and I think it's probably right. You've been there for a long time. I always think about, are there ever children, let's just take the extreme, a week before they turn 18, that they go out and decide to make money by prostituting themselves and they're not coerced? You've not found that. I just wondered if there were, and it doesn't sound like, if there are, there are very few that would ever be like that.
Well, that's
Sergeant
the big...
Snyder.
Yep. Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. That's the big elephant in the room. And when I talk to groups of law enforcement officers, defeating the biases that we carry about women and prostitution, that's one of the big things now that we're working toward. You know, in all reality, I can't tell you that never happens where there's a woman that turns 18 years old or 38 years old and needs money or something and doesn't find herself or put herself in that situation. But the reality of it is, in listening to the stories, the words that these victims tell me, and I do refer to them as victims, over time, this is an inherently coercive decision. It's an inherently bad situation or series of situations that led them to that point. There's nothing that can convince me in the time that I've spent and the women that I've sat across the table from that would convince me that, that anybody's made this choice willingly.
Last follow-up.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What do you I heard you talk about women. I'm assuming men, too, of course. Can you tell me the ratio of men to women in that are children being exploited in this? Do we have any stats on that?
Ms. McKenzie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, we don't have a good handle on the numbers, but what we have found throughout this 18-month process that going through this, that we really need to be better understanding the needs of sexually exploited boys, making sure that we are getting the evidence-based models to have effective responses for them, especially GLBT boys who are out on the street. And this is something that this model contemplates, that we have to have some dedicated services and then start evaluating what works for them. Obviously, this is something that affects kids of both genders, and the services would be available and needed for both, but they may be different.
Sergeant Snyder, to follow up on Senator Hall's questions, at what point, I mean, this bill covers 16 and 17-year-olds, so when they're an 18-year-old victim, at what point does the system start to treat them as adults responsible for their own criminal conduct versus victims who remain under the sway and control of a trafficker? How do you handle that balance? And is that something that's left to prosecutorial discretion or law enforcement discretion? Do you feel compelled when someone's 18 to refer it to the county attorney's office for consideration of charges? And how do you communicate that situation to the victim that you're interviewing?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. You know, from my experience, and I have worked those details where we were doing prostitution stings back in the day, and we were, you know, picking up women off Backpage or off the streets of North Minneapolis. And I never really felt like I did right by any of them. I mean, it's true that there's that line at 18 years old where they become adults, and at that point we expect that they're going to be criminally liable for their behavior. The reality of it is with sex trafficking, in my experience, is that you know, so many of them have so many other things that have brought them to that point that 18-year-old child, so the person that turns 18, is still thinking like a 13 or 14-year-old kid who, you know, is living in those same experiences that they had before. You know, in practice, I don't typically arrest women involved in prostitution. I think that I can do a much better job for them by doing what we would call a knock and talk, doing a little bit of outreach with them, talking to them, and being that person, that individual that isn't asking for something in return, but that recognizes that, you know, they've come through a difficult spot, a difficult life to get where they are today. And I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't hope to answer for Mr. Choi in terms of the prosecution part, but I know from law enforcement, the best practices in trying to deal with that problem, you accomplish more by doing some sort of outreach than you do by criminal sanction.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, Nikki Beasley from Breaking Free couldn't be here. Her car's in a ditch because of the weather. I hope she's okay. And often we do have Sergeant Bandebeer from the St. Paul Police with us, Police Department with us as well. And my understanding is they often will take the 18 and 19-year-old to Breaking Free so that they can receive services there. But this bill is not changing the law in terms of the 18-year-olds. We really think we wanted to focus on the under 18-year-olds. But I think the reality is if the average age of entrance is 14, you know, there's a whole lot of self-esteem issues. They may have been abused at home, which is why they ended up being a runaway and being vulnerable and subject to the flattery and the coercion of a trafficker. But, you know, we're not looking at anybody who is an adult who, you know, trade sex, if you will, on a one-to-one level with no pimp or trafficker involved. I mean, that's a whole other issue.
Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I had a couple questions. First, perhaps Ms. McKenzie can give me a little insight. For the last few years, I've been hearing a statistic that says that Minnesota is like the 13th most prolific state in sex trafficking. Do you know the source of that? I keep hearing it, and I've asked law enforcement to give me a clarification, and they don't know what I'm talking about. So could you lend some light on that statement?
Ms. McKenzie.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, thank you for that question. That is a question that we also dug into, and we did trace the source of that back to an FBI initiative that I believe, I'm not going to get the year right, but in 2003 was looking at making sure that cities with high concentrations of criminal enterprises relating to child prostitution were participating in a federal law enforcement program. Now, so 13 cities were chosen nationwide. We don't know if it was the rank order, the top 13, or if it was 13 cities that may have been ready to take on that initiative. But that's where that comes from an FBI initiative around child prostitution.
It's kind of interesting.
Senator Lerman.
When I talked to some law enforcement, I actually talked to FBI people in higher up in the administration in the Minneapolis office, and they didn't know what I was talking about either. Good to know a little bit more insight on that. The other question I had, perhaps Sergeant Snyder might be able to help, or John Choi. I see that we've repealed a section of law in this bill, and it's regarding, we're repealing a proposal in the event that there's a failure to comply. This makes reference to if the child fails to complete successfully a diversion program or for whatever other reason just refuses to comply with a disposition order. Do you have another cure in the event in your bill that covers that in the event that the child doesn't successfully complete a program?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, I think the whole purpose of deleting those provisions is to say that if you're 16 or 17 years of age and you have been prostituted, that really the delinquency option is not an option. And what that child, that 16, 17-year-old child, is a child in need of protection, and so we need to start focusing on not the delinquency system, but the child protection system, and to get the intervention and services. This practice of not running the child through the delinquency system, and so then diversion and all of those issues are really off the table. This is a practice that's been implemented by the Metropolitan County Attorneys in the 7-county metropolitan area since February of 2011, and in Olmsted County and in St. Louis County. So this is kind of where we're headed in terms of when we get a case or a situation involving a child, what we believe is it's more appropriately dealt with in the child protection system or through police and prosecution, working with service providers to get the assistance and the help that that 16 or 17-year-old needs, and looking at that child not as someone who has broken some criminal law, but as a child who needs help. And that has paid dividends with respect to the prosecution of traffickers.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Senator Limmer, County Attorney Choi gave one example. The example I give is a situation that happened in downtown St. Paul and the DoubleTree Hilton, which my apartment is connected to by Skyway. And this was a 911 call from a 17-year-old from Iowa who said she was being held there against her will, and she was afraid they were going to kill her. And she had been forced to serve as 30 men during the previous week. And because they approached her not as, we're going to lock you up, you're to blame for this, and then, she would no longer trust them. They approached her with this victim-centered approach, said that it's not your fault, we're going to protect you. She then ended up testifying against the trafficker, who she was deadly afraid of, and they were convicted. So the idea is that if you can protect them and build trust with them, not only is it better for them to rebuild their lives so they don't have any kind of criminal record that they have to deal with, or they're not being treated like maybe they have been all their life as a bad person, you know, it's your fault that I, your father, raped you, or I, your uncle, raped you. You know, for the first person that, first male in particular, maybe that they've been able to trust, that didn't want something for them, from them, as Sergeant Snyder said. So that whole model now is the kind of the evidence-based model that's being used. It was tested and it's proved to be effective. And that's why we're asking to repeal the diversion model, that this is the preferred model that the county attorneys have agreed they'd like to use.
Any further questions or discussion? Senator Limmer?
Mr. Chair, one of the differences of where we went 2 years ago was that we left an option for a prosecutor in the event that the child returned to this type of activity. They were offered programming, they were offered they were offered the victim recognition. And the question was in our committee of what happens if a child returns to that, purposely going back to that life of prostitution. We thought at that time that at least the prosecution would have an option to engage a more criminal sanction as, let's say, a hammer if the carrot didn't work, the stick might. And what we're doing here is taking away the stick altogether. Is that a good way to describe it?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I firmly believe that with respect to the public safety and to get the right outcomes that the public would want us to get is to move to a victim-centered approach, and we don't need to go there. I think if it's not a choice that this girl makes to go back to this life. In fact, it's a situation involving a whole complex issues relative, and then there's a lot of coercion and threats of violence, and it's not that pretty woman scenario that Hollywood portrays. Far from it. And I'll tell you, it's very dark. And the best approach in terms of the results that I think that the public would expect is that we hold those traffickers and those Johns who are engaged in this behavior accountable and recognize that 16 and 17-year-olds truly a victim and that this is not a choice that is being made, a willing choice.
Senator, Mr. Choi, once they turn 18, if they were to return to that kind of conduct, then the option would still remain.
That is correct,
to bring
Mr. Chair.
Criminal prosecution, is that right?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Senator
Chairman,
Pappas.
I would just like to use the little comparison to domestic abuse victims. Domestic abuse victims often fail to prosecute, often return to their husbands or their boyfriends. He says he's sorry. He says he loves her. You know, it's that same kind of mentality. You've lost your self-esteem. You don't have any other options. You can't go home. You're kicked out of school or you left school. And that sense that this is the only person who cares about me is my trafficker. You know, I mean, that wasn't the situation with the Iowa girl, but in many situations, that's it. And so you have to break through that, and the criminal justice approach is not able to break through that. Then it just proves that no one cares about you but your trafficker. But the victim-centered approach creates a whole network of people then that care about you, want you to have services, want you to be safe, want you to have safe housing, want you to return to school, want you to be successful.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We call that emotional control that people have in other people's lives. Ms. McKenzie, I wonder if we could go back to something you had stated. You talked about, sounded like you were saying boys in the GLBT are into being exploited. Can you tell me why that would be? I mean, why that group?
McKenzie.
Thank you. Speak loud. Oh, there. Sorry. Thank you. She reminded me there's no microphone, so you may not be able to hear me. So, Senator, the data that we do have suggests that especially GLBT kids who run away from home enter into prostitution on the streets much earlier than girls, and that the risk of violence, they're a little bit younger, and the risk of violence to them is even greater than to girls on the streets. But again, this is something that as a working group we really struggle to get a handle on and to make sure that we're getting the services to all the kids who need them.
Mr. Chair,
Senator, follow up.
Why violence is greater than a woman?
Senator, I can't answer. I don't know.
You just know it
just
is.
Just the outcome.
More violent. Okay.
So. Seeing no further discussion, Senator Goodwin?
Yes, I would move this
Senator
bill.
Goodwin moves that Senate file 384 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing.
Yes, so moved.
Nicely made, Senator Goodwin.
Thank you.
Seeing no further discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, committee.
Thank you.
Senator St. John, Senate file 343. All right, Senator St. John, welcome to the committee.
Okay, thank you, Senator Latz and members. Before we get started, I wonder if we could distribute the author's A1 amendment, and we can discuss that. Gets the bill in order, technically.
All right, Senator St. John, I understand this is not your first stop, right?
Mr. Chair and members, no, we have been at the Jobs Committee prior to this. And
all right.
There's probably, hopefully, a long journey to go here. And
this is the A4. Members, the A4 amendment is in your packet. Senator St. John, why don't you explain the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask our counsel to do that, Lynette Crandall from the Dorsey firm. She helped me draft this up, and she's probably better able to describe the intricacies of this amendment.
All right. Ms. Crandall, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, for the record, it's Lynette Crandall with Dorsey & Whitney. And I serve as Public Finance and Economic Development Counsel to Mayo Clinic and other public and private entities across the state of Minnesota. And as Senator St. John noted, we believe that this amendment is largely technical. We are removing a special tort liability provision that is applicable to other types of economic development entities in the state. We are also clarifying that the power of eminent domain is subject to the general law in Chapter 117. Wanted to make that absolutely clear with the cross-reference to the definition of public use in Section
117.025. Now, Ms. Crandall, what are the substance of the provisions that you're deleting?
Mr. Chair, if you go to, we can walk through line by line here. Page 9,
yes.
Line 1 is again a reference to liability, similar to the tort liability provision. The new authority that's created under this legislation, it's an economic development entity similar to an EDA or an HRA that you may be familiar with in your communities. The law is actually patterned off of the Port Authority law, and so that reference to the authority not being immune from liability because of its carrying out of an essential governmental function, Council and I pondered over exactly how that might affect the existing sovereign immunity statutes in place and the related case law. It's not our intent to create any special exceptions to sovereign immunity, and so we decided that it was wise to strike that. Moving on then to page 10, section 11. Again, that's a provision that's applicable to other types of economic development entities in the state of Minnesota. We've talked to folks about that, and I think it creates some confusion. It's found throughout Chapter 469, but we don't see a need to create any special tort liability provisions for this entity. So, again, the general laws would be applicable. So that strikes all of Section 11. And then,
Ms. Crandall, would Section 11, the provision that's in there, would that have made the body more or less liable than general law?
I think there's some confusion about that generally in the community. As I've talked to some folks, talked to a representative with the trial lawyers, I think there's some ambiguity and some general discomfort around that provision. And so, again, it's not our intent to create any special exceptions for this authority. It's subject to all of the laws generally that would be applicable to another political subdivision in the state.
Okay. Thank you.
Then moving on, page 13 and page 15 are the references to the power of eminent domain. And again, the language that you see added is to make it absolutely clear that the public purpose that we state in this bill is no broader than the authority for a taking under Chapter 117. So a public use under Chapter 117 would be required for this new authority to exercise that condemnation power. And as you all are familiar with, I'm sure, in this committee, economic development alone is not sufficient to exercise the power of eminent domain in Minnesota. You did a lot of hard work in 2006 to put some more clarity to what's a sufficient public use.
Yeah, Ms. Crandall, that's a much larger discussion that we're not going to go back into. Are there any questions specifically about this amendment then?
Sure.
Senator Limmer?
Ms. Crandall, I'm looking at the amendment and I have the amendment. The insertion of new language to acquire property for a public use. Who makes that decision of what's public use or not?
Well, actually, public use is defined in 117.025, and it's defined pretty narrowly these days. Again, in 2005, I believe it was the Kelo Supreme Court decision that you probably recall, generally blessed a taking for the general purpose of economic development. And so this body did some work in 2006 to put some more parameters to that. To exercise the power today, it's necessary to do so to mitigate blight, for environmental remediation, to address abandoned property or a public nuisance. And all of those terms have definitions in statute as well. For example, blight is pretty tightly defined as to what percentage of buildings need to be structurally substandard. So the authority, being the public body, would ultimately have the ability to exercise the power by a vote of the authority board, but of course it would have to be consistent with Chapter 117.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Crandall, is the authority an elected body?
It is not an elected body. It's an appointed body.
And they have a power of asserting an eminent domain?
They do, and that would be similar to other similar entities, again, in Minnesota. An appointed economic development authority in your community, or a housing and redevelopment authority, a regional rail authority. I believe in your packet, Senator Limmer, we do have a list of some of the entities in Minnesota that have the ability to exercise the power.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
Ms. Crandall, when this authority is using that decision, they're going to claim that it's a public use. Does that mean that the public use is restricted to a public property, like a road, a park, an easement, or would it allow another entity to build upon that property that they claim is eminent domain for a secondary purpose, and that's to build something for some other corporation?
Senator Limmer, right now in Chapter 117, subsequent private use is not restricted. For example, under the that's one of the situations, the creation or functioning of public service corporations or possession of land by a public entity for public purposes. However, for example, if there is blighted property and the test can be met, there's not a restriction on subsequent private development.
Mr. Chair, I recall a situation down in the Richfield area at the intersection of the northwest corner of the intersection of 35W, I think, and 494. And the city of Richfield, this was led to the Kelo case, where the city decided to take by, I think, an eminent domain. They labeled the property as blight. They labeled an entire neighborhood as blight. And it was pretty much recognized that it was kind of a sweetheart deal, that the city did the dirty work and then gave or sold the land to the Best Buy company so they could put a new corporate headquarters at that unique corner that they desired. And it was a landmark case that cities shouldn't do that. And it also promoted legislation immediately after that as well, tightening up Minnesota law. Are you saying, Ms. Crandall, that that type of situation will not occur in this area if this amendment is included in the bill?
Senator Limmer, I am familiar with the Walzer case that you're referencing, and while I don't recall all of the facts to be able to tell you accurately today whether that would meet the new blight test that's been codified now in Chapter 117, and actually the Walzer case, I believe, was under the TIF Act under 469, so there's a separate blight test there. But the blight test today is, again, fairly restrictive, I believe, or I should say much more restrictive than prior to that case and prior to the work that this body did in 2006 to tighten it up. So if, in fact, you're in an urban area, you have 50% or more of buildings that are structurally substandard, and, again, there are trailing definitions, there have to be notices of violations, you know, simple code violations aren't necessarily enough. There has to be a sufficient enough cost found to remediate the blight conditions based on market value, I believe it is, backing out the land costs. So those restrictions would be applicable to this new authority.
Ms. Crandall, if we were to add the language on line 13 there, referencing Chapter 117, mm-hmm. Is that merely then make that whole subdivision a reaffirmation of state law as it currently exists? And if so, then what's the purpose of Subdivision 5?
Mr. Chair, that is the intent, to ensure that the restrictions in Chapter 117 for a taking by governmental entity apply to this new authority. This is just to make this express.
So the purpose of Subdivision 5 then would be to quell any fears, lest there be any doubt as to the application of Chapter 117?
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct.
Senator Goodwin, on the specific question for the amendment, please.
No. I'll wait. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer, will you move the amendment?
Yeah, I'll move the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer moves the A4 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Senjum, it's your bill.
Again, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
We are going to focus only on the provisions that are within the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee. So if you want to give us, a very brief description of the entire bill, very brief, and then we're going to focus our attention in just on those provisions before us today.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be brief, as we always are. Senate File 343 is known as the Destination Medical Center Bill, Mr. Chair and members. As it certainly involves the City of Rochester, certainly involves Mayo Clinic, and it really is all about ensuring the long-term future of Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Mr. Chair and members, what it frankly is about is we all, I think, know and recognize Mayo Clinic to be a recognized international, national health leader. We want to keep it in that vein going forward. To do that, given both national and international competition with respect to premier medical centers, there's a need to, it is felt, to upgrade, if you will, Rochester as a destination, i.e. a destination medical center. That cannot be done, Mr. Chair and members, within the framework of an existing city tax base. There's simply not enough city property tax that is available to accommodate that kind of a transition, a transformation of our city. So as we look forward, what we're talking about here, Mr. Chair, is recognizing Mayo currently brings in about nearly $4 billion of revenue per year into the state of Minnesota. That would be augmented going forward with an additional projected $3 billion. It's a matter, Mr. Chair, of capturing that increment, or portion of that increment going forward, and applying that to local infrastructure needed to make this project work. So I'm going to stop there in the essence of being brief, and we can get into the details of your interest and your discussion. Perhaps before I do that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Patty Simmons, a Mayo physician and otherwise administrative leader, and she's got some comments to make.
Dr. Simmons, welcome to the committee. Nice to see you again.
Thank you, Chair Latz, honorable senators of the committee. It's a privilege to come before you, and we really appreciate the opportunity of talking about the Destination Medical Center project. Mayo Clinic has been the home of health and healing. It has been in Minnesota for 148 years. We are a destination for people from all 50 states, from over 135 countries of the world. We wish to retain this position. We think it's very good for Minnesota. It's good to have Mayo Clinic here. Its economic impact is important, and it helps define Minnesota as really a center for medical discovery and healing and health. We see in Rochester 500,000 unique patients each year. They bring 2 to 3 companions, so about 3 million people come to Rochester as visitors, plus our employees and others. And that puts a lot of stress on a small city, on a community. We have a large enterprise. We're dedicated to serving our patients' health care needs, but also to educating the health care workforce, physicians and allied health professionals, and also creating discovery through our research mission. In order to achieve these things now, we employ 34,000 people in Rochester. Mayo Clinic is the largest private employer in the state of Minnesota, and 34,000 of our people are in Rochester. We occupy about 15 million square feet, and we really would like to keep our preeminent position as a destination medical center for the world. As you can imagine, in order for us to be successful, we continually need to educate ourselves, analyze the opportunities with healthcare policy, with the marketplace, with the economy of the United States, Minnesota, and the world. Our analyses lead us to conclude that in order to retain our status as a destination medical center, we need to invest. We want that investment to be in Minnesota. It's where we believe we belong, and it's where we want to grow. We believe we can serve more patients from the United States and the world and have great market opportunity, and that it's important for our viability. For Mayo Clinic to grow, Rochester needs to grow rationally in order to accommodate what we currently have and what we anticipate bringing forward. I could talk longer. I won't. I respect your time. I'm grateful to have it. But may I please share with you three reasons why I believe this is very important for Minnesota. The first is that I'm a physician, so please understand, to me this is like the ideal medicine. It is low risk and very high opportunity to be of help. So it's the ideal sort of formula. The state of Minnesota would take very low risk. Mayo Clinic is prepared to make an investment over the 20 years of $3.5 billion, leverage additional private dollars with the assumption and understanding that the state and local government would come forward with the costs of infrastructure essential to tolerate, to support this growth. But the way that this is created, this project, no state financing occurs unless we deliver, on the promise and generate the revenue that we expect to with our private investment. But making that private investment and securing additional private partners requires some knowledge that the state would be there and the city for their parts as well. Our economic impact in Minnesota is $9.8 billion a year. This project, we believe, would add an incremental $3 billion a year. It is a very high, high opportunity. We're not aware of anything quite like it in the state. We're not sure if there's anything quite like it in the United States. Another reason we believe this is highly attractive is that Mayo Clinic invests $600 million annually in scientific research. We make discoveries. We create new technology. We create new companies. We want to locate those companies in Minnesota, and we need greater infrastructure. Part of it is our investment in order to achieve that. And finally, we were born in Minnesota. We like it. We want to stay. We intend to stay. And we believe we're good for Minnesota. We believe people in Minnesota like having Mayo Clinic here. We believe that we can continue to really assist with the growth and the development of the state. We intend with this project to grow an estimate, and we're conservative. We're Mayo Clinic. We're conservative on our estimates. But this should generate direct jobs, 25,000 to 35,000 in the course of the 20 years. So it's an unusually high-yield proposal. I thank you very much for listening to us and considering our request that you approve Destination Medical Center. I would like to add, if your imaginations are vivid today, you would see the city leaders behind me, literally, supporting this. Our city council unanimously endorsed this project. Generally, the mayor and others would be here to testify as well, but Highway 52 made them nervous today, I think. But Senator Sinchin and I braved it.
Dr. Simmons, if we'd had a rail connection to Rochester, I expect they'd all be here with you.
Senator Letts, I have great tires for the snow. Thank you, though.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Goodwin.
I have a quick question since she was just talking about the funding mechanism. I'd like to ask, I see both in Section 18 and in the kind of overview on our Senate Council, that from our Senate Council, that it looks like 33 years of money from a standing appropriation from the state general fund of up to $75 million a year. Now I calculate that to be $2.5 billion from a standing appropriation from the state general fund of up to $75 million a year. That's a whole lot more than the 500 and whatever million we're talking about here. So could you explain that?
Senator Ms. Crandall.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to defer to Ms. Crandall.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin. So this provision is similar to what we would see in a state geo bonding bill, for example, when you authorize the issuance of state bonds to cover public costs. The costs of our public infrastructure improvements are anticipated to be $585 million, and that accounts for a city contribution as well. The city of Rochester has recently dedicated $20 million of its local option sales tax to the DMC initiative. The new authority, rather than having the state issue the bonds, the new authority is, as I mentioned, would be a political subdivision of the state, a special purpose entity that would have the sole mission of securing the state of Minnesota and Rochester status as a global destination medical center. And so we would actually, what we've proposed is that the authority will issue the bonds in the par amount of $585 million as the cap. And then debt service would be paid over time from a standing appropriation. The $75 million is an absolute cap. It's higher than our current projections are running. I think the max debt service based on some pretty conservative assumptions now are in the low $40 million range. That's out about 15 years, I believe. So debt service ranges anywhere from, I believe, about $3 million to $40 million as we've projected it. And since we're talking about the issuance of the bonds, too, I wanted to touch on the jurisdiction of the committee and why the power of eminent domain is so important here. To be able to finance these public costs at the lowest possible rate, we would very much like the authority to be able to issue tax-exempt debt and take advantage of provisions under the federal tax code and also state law, where holders of those bonds would not be taxed on their interest earnings. And to be able to do that, a political subdivision in this country has to have one of three sovereign powers: the power of taxation, police power, or eminent domain. And our authority, unlike your local EDA or HRA, doesn't have any ability to tax. Certainly doesn't have any police powers. That's left up to the city. And so eminent domain is very important there. And with the ability to issue tax-exempt debt, again, current projections are that the annual appropriation from the state would be much, much lower than the $75 million.
Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, that doesn't clear anything up for me, unfortunately. It still looks as if the language says that a standing appropriation from the state general fund of up to $75 million per fiscal year from standing appropriation from the state general fund from 2016 to 2049. It says the state appropriation would be for the financing efforts and operations of the authority. That still says to me that that is a state appropriation, state funds, not private funds, not Rochester City funds, but state funds.
Certainly, Senator, and Mr. Chair, I'm happy to talk a little bit more about the financing mechanism. I don't have the summary in front of me, but I'll point you to page 20 of the bill, line 20.11, and that provides the cap on the annual transfer to the authority for the authority's bonds that would, again, be issued to finance the public costs up front. So again, the mechanism, though, is somewhat of a process working with the Department of Revenue to actually measure the incremental increase in taxes that are directly attributable to the DMC initiative and to Mayo Clinic's investment of what's anticipated to be $3.5 billion and additional private investment of approximately $2.1 billion.
Let me just...
Senator Goodwin...
Yes, Mr. Chair, I just want to...
If I may, Senator Goodwin, I'm going to suggest that possibly the bill summary that you are reading maybe just a little bit off in its description of the actual content of Section 18. I see Mr. Turner is here. Maybe you can take a look at it as well. But I just glanced at the provision, the summary that you're referring to, and it says it creates a standing state appropriation. But then the actual language in Section 18, the language itself, does not appear to create a standing appropriation. It just caps what might be appropriated in any given year. I'm not sure if there's a big distinction there, but maybe Mr. Turner can look at it, but I suspect Senator Goodwin's question may be answered there.
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, I'll look at it, and I'll speak with Senator Goodwin on the side here. I have not read this yet, and you can give me some time, I will get back to the senator.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say
this is not a provision within the jurisdiction of this
committee. I know,
I'd like
but as this goes further, I'd like to make sure that when this language, I want to find out if this language really is necessary to be in there, because what that does is it commits the state to that amount of money should any of the other revenue sources fall through. Then we will have to pay that debt with
Senator Goodman, General.
If I may, let's
ask Mr. Turner to look at the question, and that may obviate the need for any further questions, and perhaps either on the floor or in other committees, this point can be pursued further, since it's
not within our
committee's jurisdiction.
Mr. Chair, if I could...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say...
We do have another resource here that might be able to handle that question.
Okay.
If the committee would like to proceed with it.
Sure. Just briefly. Maybe we can finish this up right now.
Mr. Chair, committee members...
State your full name, sir.
My name is Bob Dunn. I'm president of the Hammes Company. We're the lead consultant for Mayo Clinic on this project. The reason for the cap, the $75 million cap, is to do just what was described, give us an absolute annual cap on the amount of appropriation that can be used to amortize the $585 million. It's not cumulative. It does not add up over a 30-year period of time to give us the ability to fund $2.3 billion. But I'll give you an example of why we need that cap. It's very likely that the authority could, in any particular year, bond finance for a portion of the project and elect to do it over a shorter schedule to amortize the debt than what we forecast in our model. As Ms. Crandall said, the model is built on a very common set of assumptions in terms of how you would bond finance, say, using GO bond financing over a 30-year period of time. But let's assume for a minute that the authority board would elect to secure its financing over a 10-year period of time to shorten the life of the bonds, to amortize them more quickly. That would cause the annualized amount of borrowing to potentially come up and reach the $75 million cap. So it's not giving the project the authority to fund more than the $585 million. It's giving the authority board the ability to potentially raise the annual cap beyond what we have projected currently for the sake of, say, amortizing the debt over a shorter period of time.
So, sir, what would be the state's total outlay under any – what's the most that the state would end up having to pay?
$585 million of capitalized expense.
Okay. But in terms of general fund appropriations over the course of time, it would –
It would be the $585 million of borrowing capacity that would be allowed for under the bill.
So out of our general fund, the state would not end up paying any more than that $585?
That's the maximum amount that we're able to borrow under the bill.
Well, that's not my question. If the state is going to be on the hook to somehow pay annual costs of borrowing, what might all of those annual payments add up to?
Well, if you take the, as with any bond financing, you've got your costs of principal being amortized and the interest payments being amortized over time. So assuming that you borrow the full $585 million over time and you amortize that over a roughly 30-year schedule and you take the principal and interest payments, it's as with any bond financing, it's more than the par amount of the bonds. It's no different than financing your home. If you have a $200,000 home and you amortize that over 30 years, you're in effect paying more than $200,000 for the home, but the value of the home is the $200,000. So this is no different than any bond financing in that respect. The maximum amount that can be borrowed is the $585, but the cost of principal and interest over time adds up to more than the $585 million.
Okay. So some subsequent committee will have to decide, and us ultimately on the floor, whether or not we want to be on the hook for that additional expense over the course of time,
yes,
which will be in excess of $585 million.
$0.5
billion.
Senator Latz, it looks like it's substantially more than that.
Yes.
I think we should be careful to present that what we're talking about here is not, as I understand it, until I understand it differently, that we're talking about $2.5 billion over the course of that time to loan out the $560 million. So if I'm misunderstanding that, great. I hope I am. But we'll have to pay attention to that.
It's certainly a question that will have to be answered before we have any floor votes on the total package. Right, members, I want to try to bring us back to the parts that are within this committee's jurisdiction, please. So we have deleted some provisions that were in this committee's jurisdiction.
Is that true?
By that First Amendment. So Section 8, Subdivision 1, which may be found on page 8 and 9. The top of page 9 was the deletion, which leaves in Subdivision 1 the remaining one sentence. Ms. Crandall, do you have anything to add? Other than it simply identifies this body or defines this body as a political subdivision of the state of Minnesota with the right to sue and be sued?
No, Mr. Chair. Nothing else to add. With the deletion of the last sentence, again, general sovereign immunity provisions would apply, I believe.
Are there any members' questions relating to that provision? All right, Section 11, we delete it in its entirety on page 10, so that is no longer a concern for this committee. Section 13, Subdivision 5, we amended in the A4 amendment after the discussion relating to the acquisition of property for public use. Then Section 14, Subdivision 5, is on page 15. Have not had a specific discussion about this. Ms. Crandall, could you please explain what this provision does?
Mr. Chair, again, like other economic development entities in the state of Minnesota, this would allow the newly created authority to acquire property by eminent domain subject to the restrictions of Chapter 117. And the acquisition of property would have to be consistent with the public purposes set forth and used for projects as defined in earlier in the bill. So largely what we're talking about here, again, is the investment in public infrastructure that will be necessary to support the Mayo development and other private development in the city over the next 20 years.
Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Crandall, if I can bring your attention to line 4 of page 5, there's a section reference of 469.41 to 5.3. It states it shall pay for the property out of money it receives under that reference. Could you tell me what that reference means?
Sorry, Senator Limmer, could you reference me to the line number again? Page 5, you said?
Page 15, line 4. This is the subdivision 5 that we're talking about.
Page 15, line 4. These would be the provisions where this legislation would be codified, 469.41 to 53.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
When this is talking about paying for property out of money it receives, is this an exception in existing law, or is this a special provision for this project? Could you give me a little bit more depth to this?
Senator Limmer, this subdivision 5, I believe, is, I will admit it, cribbed directly from the existing Port Authority law in Chapter 469. And so I believe all this does is make it clear that really the funds that this entity will receive will be the proceeds of bonds that it issues secured by the state standing appropriation.
So, Mr. Chair, if Senator Goodwin's concern about bonding is enough to diminish that bonding project, let's say, in discussion on the legislation, then this would be directly affected?
Correct.
Ms. Crandall.
Just on the bonds.
All right.
Until there's a request.
Oh, and Mr. Chair, I see that on line 2 we're talking of condemnation proceedings. Yeah. Earlier, in our meeting, we talked about eminent domain proceedings. What is the difference for eminent domain versus condemnation proceedings?
Ms. Crandall.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I am not aware of a distinction, to be quite honest. I do public finance work, and I don't do eminent domain work specifically, but I'm not aware of a distinction.
Ms. Pontius?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, yeah, I think the terms tend to be used interchangeably. Eminent domain is probably the more modern preferred term over condemnation, but you'll see them used back and forth in statutes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
The term condemnation kind of seems dark and evil and
Senator Limmer.
Ms. Crandall.
I think we would be happy to use whichever terminology you prefer.
Well, I'm just wondering which one would fit the proper legislation right now. I don't have any other question on this section, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer and members, Ms. Pontius pointed out that the amendment we adopted, the A4 amendment, did modify lines 2 and 3 on page 15. So it deleted devise, comma, and condemnation proceedings, replaced it with or devise. And then on line 3 after the period, it inserted the authority may exercise the power of eminent domain to acquire property for public use as defined in section 117.025. Condemnation, well, I'll note that on line 6, you still have the term condemnation.
That's right.
Don't know if it's anywhere else in the bill, but at least within the paragraphs specific to this committee, that appears to be the only other place. Senator Limmer, would you like to move that? Senator Dietzick?
Well, I have a question. I don't know if you were going to move the bill or a question. So.
Well, I was just going to clean up that one use of the term condemnation.
Mr.
Chair. The bill doesn't seem so dark and foreboding.
Mr. Chair, I would move any reference to condemnation be replaced with a reference to eminent domain in the bill.
Is there any further any discussion on that motion? All right, Senator Limmer moves to replace all terms condemnation with the term eminent domain throughout the bill. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Dietzick, did you have a further question or comment?
Yes, I do. Does Rochester, thank you, Mr. Chair, does the city of Rochester have a economic development authority?
Senator Dietzick and Mr. Chair, I believe there's actually, I'm aware of a joint city and county housing and redevelopment authority. And I'm not sure, again, because of the weather, I don't believe we have anyone from the city here to confirm that.
I think Senator Sendem said they don't, and I believe an EDA might be a little different than an HRA. Is there in here, because I couldn't find it, so if the city, and especially with these condemnation proceedings, if the city and the authority don't agree, is there a process to work that out? I mean, it says in here a lot that they have to work together, which I appreciate. My other concern was with if Rochester had an EDA, are we duplicating it? But Senator Sendem doesn't think they do, so I just want to make sure they're working together.
Mr. Chair and Senator
Sendem.
The best I would be able to say is, per my recollection of my city council days, which are now 10 years ago, they didn't at that point, but whether they've created one more recently, I can't say.
Senator and Mr. Chair, this bill wouldn't seek to restrict the city's authority to exercise its general economic development powers in any way. Again, we're creating a unique special purpose entity solely for the reason achieving the DMC mission.
And it appears that under the subdivision 5 that all the property that is owned by the authority is exempt from property taxes. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It would be exempt as any other political subdivision holding property. I might add that I presume because of what's being built here in Rochester, city streets, other water sewer infrastructure, those types of facilities would actually ultimately be owned and maintained on an ongoing basis by the city.
What about I would assume is all of the property currently owned by Mayo, is that subject to property tax or not?
Mr. Chair, I can't speak to the exact status. Certainly there are tax issues with respect to unrelated trade or business of Mayo as a 501c3 nonprofit that would be taxable. I believe perhaps there are other some arrangements between the city and Mayo Clinic and the county as well, but I can't speak to the specifics of that. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I may be able to help a little bit.
The
education and research components of Mayo Foundation are not taxed. The practice itself is. They pay, to the city at least, $5.9 million of property tax last year.
And so would this bill have any impact on that? Would additional, would the expansion of Mayo to new properties, sounds like it would change the tax status of that kind of property?
Mr. Chair, it would not, because no property that is financed with the authority bonds or other funds that it has available could be owned by or leased to Mayo Clinic.
What about the authority?
If the authority held property, yes, it would be subject to the exemption available to other political subdivisions.
Is it anticipated that the authority would hold property?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe it is. I can't say that there couldn't be a public plaza or open space or something of that nature in the future. But again, what we're talking about is streets, sewers, basic infrastructure, land acquisition, soil remediation, those types of things, again, that a typical EDA in the state would do.
Okay. So So the authority would be focused only on the public infrastructure part. Is that what you're creating here?
Correct, Mr. Chair. Mayo Clinic, the $3.5 billion investment that the doctor referred to, that is the Mayo. Those are the Mayo facilities. Those are dollars for Mayo constructed facilities. This authority would not have any legal authority to acquire land for Mayo or directly.
It would just
provide
be to facilitate the public infrastructure.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking over all of the documentation that's presented to us here at the desk. I understand the bill is wanting specific authority to acquire property, to define liability. Can you all just tell me, what are you doing down in Rochester? I haven't gotten a clue, aside from very scant reports that I have time to read. What do you want to do with this authority? Are you wanting to buy, just provide for a public purpose land so you can build, a private entity can build something on it and call it a public purpose? I know you got a competitive thing with other facilities around the country. I don't think that's even been addressed in this hearing. Could you just give us a little one-liner on what do you want to use this authority for?
Who wants to do it?
I will. Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer,
sir.
You're getting right at the essence of what we're looking to accomplish with the DMC. As Dr. Simmons said earlier, for Mayo to remain competitive and the worldwide leader in the practice of medicine, Mayo has to grow and grow significantly. Over the last several years, we've conducted extensive research to understand Mayo's growth, and the associated growth that has to happen within the community to make Rochester and Minnesota a more viable destination to be the worldwide leader in the practice of medicine. What that means is Mayo has to invest upwards of $3 billion to grow the medical center. Over and above that, we're projecting an additional $2 billion plus of private investment to create the kinds of development that we need in Rochester for Rochester to become a more viable destination city. And it's about everything you can imagine, from hotels, restaurants, retail, housing, commercial, research and development. Those are all, that $2 billion is outside of what Mayo's investment will be in the medical center. So we've got something approaching $6 billion of private investment to grow the medical center and the community to a point that it can compete as a viable destination in support of the medical center. In order to do all of that, as you probably can imagine, there are basic infrastructure needs that any community has to support. The challenge we have in Rochester is the growth is so significant, it outpaces any amount of infrastructure building that a city on its own using its normal and standard resources can support. I would liken it to saying if here in the cities, you know, you grew your downtown employment in Minneapolis by 50%, 60% in a very short period of time, it would put an infrastructure burden on any city that the city alone can't support. That's what the $585 million is going to be used for. It's to build core city infrastructure, but only those elements that are extraordinary costs over and above what the city can shoulder using its resources that are available to it today. The city today spends about $60 million every year on capital investment. About 20% of that goes into the downtown core. Well, running that out over time, Rochester, the city of Rochester, its infrastructure at that level of investment will be dwarfed by the private investment that's coming here. So those dollars will go into the types of things that Ms. Crandall spoke about: site costs, land acquisition, remediation, pedestrian traffic, transit, civic elements, the kinds of core infrastructure that any community that will experience this level of growth will have to have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your clarity. Appreciate that.
All right. Is there any further discussion on the
one further question? If I could turn your attention to page 4, we have a purpose section, and I'm wondering if that's even necessary to be in the bill. As you may recall, a previous chair of this committee, Senator Betzold, was very critical of findings and purposes in any bill. And sometimes these types of things get in the way of other things like legislative intent, because it's basically, well, in lack of another term, it's a sales pitch we're putting into law. And sometimes it does get in the way of little things like legislative intent, and we want to make sure that the legislative intent is clear. And I think it's important for our committee to have a discussion of whether or not this is even needed in the bill. I don't think it has any substantive elements to it, and I'm just wondering if anyone else has the same opinion as I might.
Ms. Crandall, or someone, Senator Senjum, what is
I would offer, Senator Limmer, when I first saw this bill, I was reminded of Senator Betzold and his thoughts relative to purpose and there was a period of time, at least within our legislative experience, where things like that were excised out of bills.
I am informed also that was the practice under Senator Speer when he chaired this committee. Any offerings as to the substantive legal purpose of Section 5?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, no. There is not intended to be any substance, in the purpose section. That's found later in the bill, and so if that's the desire of the committee to follow that practice, I know sometimes it happens at the revisor's office to me, and sometimes it doesn't. So,
Mr. Chair, I would move that we strike Section 5 from the bill.
Senator Limmer moves to delete Section 5. Is there any discussion on that motion? Not hearing any discussion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Is there any further discussion on this bill?
Well, I think that there will be financing discussions at another point, correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
This bill from here is going to state and local government, and with the appropriations, I'm sure it will end up in the Finance Committee as well. And I'm told it will go to rules at some point. So, Mr. McGrath, I saw you on the list of testifiers. Did you wish to say anything further, or say anything at all?
Mr. Chairman.
All right. Is there any further discussion from the committee, then? Is there a motion?
I will move the bill. I think there's a lot of discussion. I would hate to see the Mayo leave, but I will move the bill and forward it to its next committee.
Senator Dietzick moves that Senate File 343, as amended, be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
May I amend the motion to make it a motion to move without recommendation so that we're not saying we recommend the proposal,
right,
but we're moving the bill for further consideration?
Well, I guess either Senator Dietzick accepts that as a friendly amendment to her motion, or we have a separate vote on Senator Ortman's motion to amend the motion.
I will accept that as a friendly amendment.
Thank you.
All right. Then the motion before the committee is Senator Dietzick's motion as amended that Senate File 343 pass without recommendation and be re-referred to the Senate Committee on State and Local Government. Say that right.
Yes, as amended.
Yes, as amended. Yes. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator St. John.
Very much, Mr. Chairman and members.
Senator Hayden.
Yeah.
Senate File 250. Senator Hayden, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Go ahead and speak on behalf of your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 250. In 2007, the state of Minnesota and the tribes executed an agreement providing for the transfer of pre-adopted placement cases to tribal court. In 2011, the state Supreme Court overruled the district and Court of Appeals decision. The Supreme Court's decision was based on the fact that the state did not have the statutory authority to transfer pre-adoptive placement to tribal court. The bill returns the proceedings to where the state and tribes agree these matters will be best addressed while providing protections for the litigants. This bill will not significantly alter the court system, simply would return to how the system had been operating until October 2011's decision. This bill is necessary to address the court's finding that the transfer of such cases is not statutorily authorized. What the bill is asking is that the legislature is nothing new. The legislature has expanded the protections afforded Indian children under the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act. Previously, the legislature expanded the definition of an Indian child. Mr. Chair, I think I also have a author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that it needs
correct,
to move.
Correct, members. This is the bill's first stop. So there's the A1 amendment, which is in your packets.
Mr. Chair, I move the amendment.
Senator Limmer moves the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Hayden, you have a couple of testifiers here with you today.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. I have Andrew Small and Sarah Van Norman, which will also go over the bill with you.
Thank you, both of you. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the record before you speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Sarah Van Norman. I'm an attorney at the law firm of Jacobson Buffalo in St. Paul, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, of which there are six member bands. The Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, along with, we understand, every other tribe in the state, supports this change to the statute. In fact, this is simply getting back on course our state's strong tradition of Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, protections. Minnesota has been a leader since the passage of the ICWA in 1978 in assuring and expanding those protections for Indian children and their families. Our state courts and tribal courts, before this decision came out, regularly dealt between them with appropriate means for effecting transfers, timing for effecting transfers, how to handle particular questions of a tribe's involvement in the case. And we are asking this body to simply return to those same standards because, frankly, the Minnesota Supreme Court got this one wrong. Our options here are simply to make a simple change to the language at this point. This language formerly appeared in, as the Senator stated, the state tribal agreement in 2007 negotiated between the tribes and DHS. You'll note that actually that agreement was nothing new at that time. Since the 90s, there's been an agreement of that kind in Minnesota, and it's something that's expressly allowed under the ICWA. So what we're asking, in essence, is for this body to recognize that tribes do indeed have concurrent jurisdiction over these types of pre-adoptive cases with the state. It's not a one or the other thing. And we want to leave it to tribal courts and state courts to work out how to appropriately handle those transfers, not to cut them off artificially based upon the type of case.
Thank you, Mr. Small.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for some background to the committee members, I submitted a statement on behalf of the Minnesota Tribal Court Judges Association.
Yes, sir, we have it, and it has been distributed to the members.
Okay, thank you. Also, for some background, I have been involved in the statutory changes that the legislature made in 2007 to improve the Indian Family Preservation Act, and was involved in the TSA drafting, as well as the judge's bench book, the first chapter ever that had an ICWA chapter in it. So I'm quite familiar with the laws that we're dealing with. What I wanted to offer to the committee was some of the practical effects of this. The County Attorneys Association, with all due respect, has indicated in its writings that this is a late-stage transfer, and the explanation seems to be for that you don't want a child to languish in the system by having to transfer back to a tribal court system. The fact of the matter is that that process, once someone petitions for a transfer to a tribal court, happens very, very quickly. I started in 1994 as a children's court judge in tribal courts, and I've had any number of these things transferred to me from foster care and termination all the way through pre-adoptive and adoptive proceedings. And when we get a notice of one of these things, we don't spend months and months and months trying to determine whether or not we're going to do that. There are some tribes that leave that decision to their tribal governing bodies, and that does extend the process. But when you're talking about court-to-court jurisdiction, you're not talking about any child languishing in a process that takes as little as a week to get done. And I'm speaking from experience. I've done these now for 20 years in the state of Minnesota, and this is a practice that has gone on in Minnesota prior to the Supreme Court's decision in 2011. all the time. The case that the Supreme Court dealt with here, the tribe was participating in the case all the way through closely with the county, and the judge, tribe petitioned several days after the judge had made a determination that this placement after termination should go into pre-adoption, and a very short time passed, even though it was quote-unquote late in the proceedings. The tribe had been involved all along. Had it gone back to the tribe, the near guarantee of this child being tribally placed, which is the intent of the ICWA in the first place, was vastly increased. We have a problem in the state of Minnesota still with the judiciary and with those that work in the judiciary not being able somehow to follow the mandate of the act to make sure that we have children from tribal homes getting back together with families or children that have tribal affiliation having the opportunity to get with a tribal family or an extended family member, which sometimes could amount to 100 people. But my point is that you're not extending, you're not lengthening any process, and the fact that it's in a pre-adoptive placement, if a tribe has been participating, doesn't even affect the proceedings. And again, I say this from my own experience. Now, obviously, you can have, I admit that you can have some delays because administratively, when that decision is made, it can take a longer period of time. And you all know that as members of the judiciary, that administrative process can take longer than it should. But the argument that this is a late stage proceeding and we should be making legislation to encourage earlier participation is not, in my opinion, if you will, is not a valid criticism of this this procedure. At a late stage proceeding, the child is in a much better position if the tribal court is in a position to determine where that child will go for pre-adoptive placement or adoptive placement, and that's the whole purpose of the act.
Thank you, sir. Any questions of either of these testifiers? If not, we'll move on to those opposed to the bill.
Mr. Chair, may I add one additional comment?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. I wanted to assure this body, in case I didn't do so clearly beforehand, this body does have the authority to make this change, even though there is a Supreme Court case from this state that reads the law in a way that frankly, federal law doesn't require. This body can make the change. We see no legal impediment to that, but we're available to answer questions about that.
May I, Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, may I make a...
Yes, please go ahead, sir.
I would just add to that statement that if there's a fear that there's a federal law that would block this, if there's anything that would keep this from happening in federal law, keep a state from providing this opportunity, there is nothing in federal law relative to child custody proceedings.
Mr. Small, the Minnesota Supreme Court was interpreting the federal law. Is that right?
That's correct.
If you could just clarify for the committee, how is it that the Minnesota statute would be involved here?
I'm not certain of your question. I'm sorry.
Well, Minnesota passed a law which supplements or enhances federal law. Is that right?
That's correct.
And was it the absence of certain provision in the state statute that led the Supreme Court to conclude federal law controlled and did not allow jurisdiction to transfer the placement?
That was the Minnesota Supreme Court's interpretation of the ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act, the federal law. The federal law does not prohibit the state from enacting its own laws that enhance the protections that are in the ICWA, and that's where the Minnesota Supreme Court fell down, because there's no such thing in federal Indian law across the board unless there is something expressly stated that limits tribal jurisdiction. So you, as a state legislature, can enact your own laws relative to that, and there's nothing in the federal law that prohibits it. But in answer to your question, the Supreme Court was looking at federal law and then also found nothing in state law that provided for that. And that's why we're here before you today, to demonstrate that state law can provide for it. Okay. If you wish.
So it's been a long time since I read the decision, although I did actually read the decision at one point. So as I recall, if the state expressly authorizes the transfer of jurisdiction, then that is permitted by federal law. And did the state Supreme Court recognize that federal law allowed that? They just didn't find a state provision to do it?
No, they found that the act was silent on that, and the fact that Congress did not include pre-adoption and adoptive placements in the language for transfer meant that the Congress didn't intend to do it. So there was no authority in the federal act to do so.
But they also provided states can pass their own laws that could grant that authority.
But the Supreme Court,
we had not done so.
That's correct.
Okay, and that's what you're seeking to do.
That's correct.
Got it. Okay. We do have a request to testify from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Why don't you come on forward, please? Mr. Kingery, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Kingery, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I'd like a fact sheet, if I could have that handed out, if I get the page to...
Sure.
As I think you're finding out, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is a very complicated area, and so I asked the members of our Juvenile Law ICWA subcommittee to prepare a one-page fact sheet on it, which they did. Unfortunately, I think it, the font may be size 8 to get it on. And we did share a copy of this with the author earlier. Thank you. The fact sheet refers to the House
Actually,
file.
Senator Hayden, can you read font 8?
I have my bill glasses on, so I think I can read
okay.
Mr.
Bill glasses. Mr. King.
Mr. Chairman, again, as it refers to the House file, but it's the companion to Senate File 250. Again, a very complicated area. It's one in which there are certainly differences, legitimate differences of opinion. And I've asked the co-chair of our Juvenile Law Committee, Assistant Sherburne County Attorney Tracy Harris, to testify with regards to the bill this afternoon.
Ms. Harris, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am Tracy Harris from the Sherburne County Attorney's Office, and I primarily handle the child protection cases. And I am the co-chair of the Minnesota County Attorney's Association Juvenile Law Committee, as Mr. Kingery stated. The handout provided to you does give history of the Indian Child Welfare Act, at least in summary fashion, and also the current law. In front of you is a bill, Senate File 250, that seeks to allow the transfer of Indian child welfare cases at the pre-adoptive and adoptive stages in the child protection process. And I believe that this bill is in response, I think it's explicitly in response to the Minnesota Supreme Court in Ray Welfare of Child of RS. And we believe, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, that the Minnesota Supreme Court got it right. We also believe that any further interpretation of federal law needs to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. We also believe that any change to the Indian Child Welfare Act, ICWA, needs to happen at the federal level. I do want to state what we are in support of. We are in support of the preservation of the cultural heritage of Indian children. We're supportive of tribes receiving notice and participating actively in the child protection process, which currently under the law they are afforded and are invited to do. In every case that we have Indian children, we immediately reach out to the tribe that's identified to get their involvement as soon as possible. And while you heard some testimony from tribal representatives here today, I don't believe that all the tribes are represented today, and there's certainly variation among the tribes in terms of their response time to our request to participate in the child protection process and how quickly transfers happen and the changes that happen for children if a case is transferred. So I don't think there's uniformity, I guess is what I'm saying. We support the transfer of cases involving Indian children at the early stages of the child protection process, because we believe that by engaging the tribe sooner in tribal court and having them take jurisdiction over these cases, they can then put in place the services. They're more actively involved in a placement. Maybe they differ with what the county has in mind, and they can then make those decisions, and they can move the case forward without disruption to the child. We're in support of tribal participation in all the decisions that happen in the district court. In fact, we are very vigilant about the Indian Child Welfare Act to involve the tribes, and we understand that the law mandates that. We also respect that they have that right to participation. We support foster care placement in the Indian Child's family members' homes or other identified Indian foster homes. And we also support adoption, adoptive placements in identified Indian homes. But most of all, I think at the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, we support stability and consistency for all children and permanency when they can't be returned home. And Minnesota has worked hard to enact laws so that children don't languish in foster care, so that there is consistency and stability for kids. Because we've learned that there's a secondary kind of trauma that happens when children are placed in foster care and they're not returned home, and then there's a delay in finding them a permanent home, and there's movement maybe out of the first foster home into several foster homes. And we're trying to diminish the amount of transition and disruption for children, and that's the goal. We are opposed to this bill because we do believe it is a later stage in the child protection proceedings, and that at this point, in this later stage of pre-adoptive and adoptive proceedings, reunification has failed at this point. Because the parent is either unwilling or unable to correct the conditions that led to the out-of-home placement. The child has probably been in placement for 6 to 12 months at this point. There's likely been a home that's identified for the adoption of this child. And all of the players involved, the judges, the social workers, guardians, the attorneys, have been working on this case. They know this case, and we try to keep those same players consistently throughout child protection matter because we think it's best for children if they stay with the same people who understand their situation. If tribes were to transfer at an earlier stage, we believe that the disruptions that we're talking about here wouldn't happen. There would be stability for children. But this bill supports the tribe coming in at a later stage and possibly moving the child. Certainly there would be new players, people that need to get caught up to speed with what's happening in this case, possibly new a new foster home for this child, new adoptive home, and we think that is not in the best interest of children. And in Minnesota, that is the paramount consideration in child protection cases, is the best interest of the child. So I guess the last point I want to make is that in the Indian Child Welfare Act and also in the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act, it provides that a parent's objection to the transfer to tribal court is an absolute veto to the transfer. For the tribe to come in at this late stage and ask for a transfer, there is no longer this absolute veto that has been provided in law, because at this point, at this stage, the parent's no longer involved. Their rights have been terminated. They've already consented to the adoption of their child. They probably named somebody they want to adopt their child. Or we've had a trial on it, and it's been proven that termination is in the child's best interest and the parent's not fit to regain custody. But at this stage, the parent can no longer say whether or not their child, the welfare of their child is going to be decided in tribal court. So we also think that that's significant. So in summary, as frontline attorneys in these cases, we don't believe that the late transfer of this case serves the best interest of individual children. Based on the points that I've already made, and I think the handout will help also inform your decision about why this is not a bill that should be passed, and we do oppose and we ask that you not approve it. Thank you.
Ms. Harris, I have a question for you. In your opinion, is there room within the federal law to recognize state law such as proposed as controlling if this were to pass?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm used to being in court.
You can call me that, too.
we believe that if the federal law does not expressly state it, then they meant not to state it. And they did expressly state that, transfer could happen in two types of proceedings, in the termination of parental rights and for involuntary foster care placement. So I think that we're opposed, we're obviously opposed to the proponents of this bill in that they think if it's not stated, then the states are allowed to fill in the gaps. And we think that if the federal law doesn't state it, then they meant to leave it out.
Is there any provision in federal law that addresses that, that expressly states, says that the state may supplement or enhance the proceedings by their own law?
My understanding is that in federal law, it does provide for states to augment, just to afford more protection, but it doesn't state that state law can go beyond the two scenarios that they set out as when cases should be transferred to tribal court.
And Ms. Harris, you would not view this proposal as providing more protection?
I would not view it as providing more protection. I think that it goes beyond the bounds of what the federal legislation had in mind when they did craft it so that it only included the termination of parental rights and the involuntary foster care placement.
So does federal law now allow for the early stage transfer? Those areas 1 and 2 are earlier stages in this process?
It does. But as I testified to, the parent can object to this transfer, and also the court can deny it if there's good cause to believe that it would not be in the best interest of the child.
And what's the how long does it typically take to get to stage 3, if you will, to the pre-adoptive placement stage?
The law in Minnesota just changed so that now all children have to be in court for a permanency review at 6 months. It used to be that children under 8, their cases need to be reviewed at 6 months to see the progress of the parent, and that the social services needs to be concurrently finding a permanent home in case reunification is not possible. And then the older kids could, their cases could wait up to 12 months before we look at permanency and kind of draw the line for the parent. Now all children have their permanency reviews at 6 months because we're understanding through research that to keep children in placement even for a year is detrimental unless the parent's actually making progress and it looks like reunification is possible.
So help me understand the process here. A child gets removed from the home because there are concerns going on. They get placed in foster care. And then within 6 months, there has to be some evaluation of whether to permanently terminate parental rights.
That's correct. If they're placed out of the home, then social services works, immediately on a case plan with the parent to try to achieve reunification, which is the goal. Concurrently, we're looking for where can this child go immediately so that, first of all, they're comfortable. Do we have a family member, a friend, somebody they know that we can license for foster care? But also who would maybe serve as a permanent option in the event that the reunification is not possible because we don't want to move children later on. Social services then works with the parents to achieve reunification, but at 6 months, we come back into court and we look at the parents' progress. We look at their contact with the child, and ultimately the judge will decide to extend another 6 months if it looks like the parent is making progress, they're working their case plan, and they're in contact with the child, and it's in the child's best interest. So then we continue to go down the reunification road. 12 months ultimately is the outer timeline, for reunifying. And if a parent is not in a position to reunify at that point, then we do file a petition for either termination, transfer of custody, or one of our other permanency options. But we can do it at any point during the 12 months. We don't have to wait.
What's the outer limit under current law for when, under this proposal, a tribal court could intervene and say they want jurisdiction?
There isn't an outer limit. It's just when it gets to the point of the termination of parental rights proceedings, which could be, like I said, it could be right out of the gate when a child is removed, up to 12 months. So there isn't an actual timeline in there. The Bureau of Indian Affairs has actually issued guidelines in the past to help interpret ICWA, and they stated when a party who could have petitioned earlier waits until the case is almost complete to ask that it be transferred to another court and retried, good cause exists to deny the request. And they also say that the request to transfer shall be made promptly after receiving notice of the proceedings. So there isn't a definite timeline that needs to be met, but earlier transfer is encouraged.
So those two criteria, the good cause to deny and the requirement for prompt request for transfer, would remain in place.
Correct.
Would they not, whether or not this proposal becomes law, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
So typically within 6 months to a year, you'd be at sort of the outer limits for a tribal court to request jurisdiction or transfer? In the vast majority of cases, would that be accurate?
Mr. Chair, in the vast majority of cases, we would be deciding between the 6 month and 12 month period of time whether or not we're terminating rights. And they can intervene and transfer the case at the point when rights are terminated. So they still.
And then the pre-adopted placement point, which is the point at which now this legislation directs, and that would come up typically within also those 6 to 12 month.
Mr. Chair, it could actually come up after the 12 month, because if we get to 12 months, reunification.
What's
is
most
not,
common?
It's pushing towards 6 months now with the new legislation that we have to review it earlier for all children, but probably 12 months, you know, because we give parents every opportunity to reunify.
Okay,
in that
so
time.
Somewhere typically between 6 and 12 months is when the pre-adoptive placement process would begin if it were going to. And that would be the stage at which, if this legislation passed, a tribal court could ask for jurisdiction, right?
Correct. But it so varies,
outer,
I can't say.
I'm trying to get a general idea.
Sure.
I don't like legislating based on one case.
Yep.
But if I can get a general sense of what the timeline is, I have a better idea.
Well, Mr. Chair,
so then,
I'm sorry.
The ultimate question then is, if the tribal court were to obtain jurisdiction even after 9 months or 12 months, but they're making a permanent placement or adoptive decision, right? That's what the point would be? Or would they, if they obtain jurisdiction, they could continue a foster placement or they could continue to work with reunification, they just end up taking control over the whole case?
They could, Mr. Chair, they could decide that the child doesn't get adopted at all.
Okay. But if the state court made a decision to grant adoption, then essentially that child is permanently outside the tribal system after that, right?
If the state court terminates the parental rights, the child's freed up for adoption. So then if the case is transferred at that stage, then the tribe can decide whether the child stays in the adoptive home they've been in, likely prior to that point, or whether they get moved again. They can decide that they don't want the child to be adopted, that the child just stays in a family's home and never gets adopted. So they could change the course of whether or not permanency is actually accomplished for this particular child.
But as could state court, right?
State court is bound by Minnesota law saying that we have the outer date of 12 months to petition the court and move forward with permanency.
So there will definitely be a permanent decision, not an indefinite continuation in foster care under state court?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
But tribal court would have the options to do whatever they want, basically, if they obtain jurisdiction.
That's my understanding.
Okay. So then the question, so the ultimate policy question for me is balancing the interest in comparatively speedy decisions, so the child has a sense of security in what their future is going to be, versus the tribe's interest in having long-term connection, or having that child have long-term connection and membership in the tribe. Membership is probably not the right term, but connection and feeling of belonging to the tribe. Am I kind of setting the two policy questions aside, assuming we've got the legal authority and it would have the legal effect that's desired by the bill's proponents?
Mr. Chair, I guess I would just say that the second point you made, that it's in the tribe's interest to keep the connection, is also true if it never got transferred to the tribe. Because under ICWA, we have to find placements that are consistent with ICWA, which means there's a preference for the child's Indian family, a preference for tribal families, a preference for Indian families out of the gate for the child to be placed. So I would just say that in the state court system, we also are looking to keep the child connected to the tribe, identifying with their culture, So I don't think that's the difference. I think the difference is, as frontline attorneys, we're seeing this, you know, play out just in terms of timelines. And when it remains in the state court, the child's probably going to remain in the same pre-adoptive home. The same people are looking at this case. The service providers are going to be known to the child because they get to know the child over that period of time. So there's more stability throughout the case. If it's transferred, there's not only this potential for not achieving permanency on time, but also a lot of change and disruption for this child.
But it would be a return to the culture that the child grew up in, presumably, as well, right?
Mr. Chair, I think a lot of these children, if they're already connected with the tribe, they are connected to family members, and they maybe are involved in certain ceremonies already. So I don't know that there's a disconnection and then there becomes a connection. Again, we try so hard to work with the tribes throughout this the child protection proceedings to make sure the connections remain that already existed and that are formed that didn't already exist.
Okay. And just one last question. My understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that the probability of permanent placement from the state court into a tribal family is quite small in comparison to the permanent placement in a non-tribal family for any particular child that's being determined by the state court. Is that right?
Not sure if I understand.
In other words, most kids, if they're in a pre-adoptive, if they're in a foster family that's not a member of the tribe, the odds are very, very strong that when they're permanently placed in an adoptive family, it's not going to be a tribal family. Is that right? Just as a matter of statistically.
Well, Mr. Chair, we try really hard with the NHL welfare cases to...
I understand you try, but the question is, where do they end up? My understanding of the statistics is that they usually don't end up back with a tribal family anywhere. Am I wrong about that?
If we're able to place children right away in the tribe's identified foster home, which is why we want to get them involved right away, and we look for their involvement, and sometimes we call and call it to try to get their involvement, then the child isn't going to have to move. Then the child could be placed immediately in a tribal home, in an Indian-identified home, in a family member's home. So I don't know if it were to be transferred at the late stage to tribal court, if the chances would be better that the child would end up in a home that's identified by the tribe, because we would hope that the tribe's been involved the whole time. And they've already identified where the child should go, and that we've already effectuated that earlier on. I don't know if that answers your question. I'm trying to understand.
Let's say that they're in a non-tribal family right up to the point where you get to the pre-adoptive placement stage, the stage where this bill would take effect. Where do they usually end up?
Okay. I understand your question. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Because of the best interest of the child, we would hope that they could maintain the connection.
Where do they usually end up? In a family that is a member of the tribe or in a family that is not tribal? Simple question.
Sure. They usually end up in the home where they've been forming the relationships, probably the home they were initially placed in.
Thank you. If I raised any questions from members of the committee. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Let me make sure it's Ms. Van Norman, right?
Ms. Harris.
Harris. Norman, sorry. It's say your name again. No, it's okay. You can stay. What was your name again?
Ms. Harris. Tracy Harris.
Harris. Thank you. Let me see it here. If I'm trying to understand the county's position that that retaining authority at the pre-adoption level after termination of parental rights upholds the objective of speedy, permanent, secure placement, that's the priority of the interest of the child. That's correct? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct.
And also, I think I've heard you say that you believe that you're not saying this, but you're suggesting, at least, to the tribes that they would not share or be concerned about that stable, rapid, secure placement if it was in their authority to pick up the ongoing work for the child at the pre-adoption or adoption phase. You're assuming that that's what you want to do, but that that's not necessarily what the tribes would want to accomplish. Because it seems to me that the tribes can keep the child in the foster placement that's been established as easily as the courts can, the county can, if that's in the best, if they see that as the best interest of the child. But their interest is in looking for permanent placement that would allow them to stay within their culture. Is that a is that not also an important factor to consider in the long-term well-being of the child?
Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll try to address as many things from your question as I can. I don't presume that any particular tribe would not identify a home and try to establish permanency for a child. Tribes vary throughout the state. And my colleagues would tell you there are some tribes we call and we say, you know, we have an IFA case. Can you get involved? What's your input? And we don't get calls back. Other tribes, it's not the case. You know, they're very involved. So I don't know that there's a consistency. So I don't know that I can say that all tribes would do a certain thing. I don't know. I know that in the state courts, though, there are very strict timelines that we have to meet. And so I guess we're just saying that an earlier transfer would be fine, and they can then make all the decisions for that child throughout the life of the child protection case. But at a late stage where termination has already happened and we're looking at a pre-adoptive home, presumably if the tribe is asking to transfer at that case, it may be because they don't like the identified home, which may actually be a home that the parent identified for their child. So it just concerns us that at the late stage that there would be a lot of disruption for the child.
Senator Hayden,
Senator Sharon,
based on your interaction with the tribes, because we have letters from five tribes here supporting this, how do you hear the response to this, that an issue is a disagreement with the plan placement and that the tribes are not happy with those decisions and that that's the motivation for their wanting to pick up the transfer at this time?
Senator Hayden, before you answer, I'm just going to make a housekeeping announcement. We're not going to get this afternoon to Senate Files 490 and 668. Apologize to those who have been waiting. We are going to take them up tonight. We are going to be reconvening at 6 o'clock, and we'll take those two bills up first in that order. So I see, include my former colleague at the Attorney General's Office, John Kerwin, has been sitting here during the hearing. And sorry, John, but we just can't move that quickly today. So we'll ask you to come back at 6 o'clock tonight in this same room here. But we will complete Senator Hayden's bill before we adjourn our recess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon. I'm going to let Ms. Van Norman kind of answer the body of the question, but I do think it was compelling that Ms. Harris's testimony, I think, started to get at the crux of the matter here, which is that at the late stage, the giving up the court, the state court, or the counties, kind of giving the power over to the tribes, places it, I think that they're at loggerheads with what the tribe then may do that could be different than what the court has already done and planned at that late stage. And so I think when Ms. Harris said that the tribe could make a different decision than they've already made about where the permanency or where the permanency of that child would be, that would be problematic. And from some perspective, not to argue against my own bill, I see where the counties would have some issue. But I think that what we're talking about here, what's important, and I'll let Ms. Van Norman talk about how it works there, is the issue of culture and the issue of the tribes getting involved, not only wanting to make sure that they have the best interest of the child's welfare, but also including in the child's welfare their culture and who they are, and at the essence, making sure that Indian children are not that, and I'm not suggesting that the courts or the county does not have that same desire, but I do think that it is in this bill. First of all, this is what we've been doing, and I think it is we feel, or at least I feel, in bringing the bill forward, that the tribe would be in the best position to make the determination for that child's permanency. But I'll let Ms. Van Norman kind of build on that and hopefully I didn't go too far.
No, thank you, Senator. I believe that your question, Senator Sharon, was about the assumption that tribes did not have the same focus on permanency and the best interests of these Indian children as a state court that has handled the case up to the pre-adoptive placement stage might. Is that right?
Yeah, it sounds as though that's what it sounds like to me when I listen.
Well, I would agree with you that is what it sounds like. We heard a parade of horribles about what tribal courts might do. And it is strange to us to hear that on the tribal side. And again, I'm here representing all six member bands of the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe today. It's strange to us to hear that, especially from the county attorneys, because the county attorneys in the case that we're here to address supported the tribal position. They supported transfer at the pre-adoptive stage. Until 2011, we were all operating under the assumption that tribal courts have concurrent jurisdiction, a principle that's thoroughgoing in federal and state law in domestic relations matters. It was not news. What's news is this change. The county attorneys, too, were involved and consulted in the tribal-state agreement that helped enshrine this provision about pre-adoptive transfers. So the question here is really, what changed? Simply because this decision issued in 2011. Why are the county attorneys here today opposing this and making claims that, frankly, are pretty detrimental to longstanding relationships with tribes and tribal courts and in dealing with ICWA cases? Well, frankly, the testimony that you've heard reflects some lack of familiarity with ICWA cases. As a frontline attorney, someone who represents tribes in these cases, I don't understand the presentation from the county side. Here's what you heard in the RSVLS case in the briefing that the county attorney there did, and they maintained this position in the district court and in the Court of Appeals and in the Minnesota Supreme Court, and this was the Fillmore County attorney. And this gives you an idea of what actually happened in that case. This isn't some tribe swooping in at the last moment. In this case, transfer to the White Earth Tribal Court is appropriate. ICWA was designed to promote stability in Indian tribes and communities. SS will have every culturally appropriate service she requires at White Earth. The tribal court has the same protections in place as the district court. A guardian ad litem is available to be appointed. The White Earth Social Services workers have been performing the bulk of the work on this case, finding a culturally appropriate pre-adoptive home and searching for potential adoptive parents with Indian heritage. Arguably, transfer at this point in the proceeding is the most appropriate in this case. The family resides in Fillmore County, and having the trial in Fillmore County provided a more convenient forum. The White Earth Band participated in that trial. Upon termination, the remaining involved parties are social workers, the guardian ad litem, and the child. Transfer at this point will not place an undue hardship on any party. Therefore, the court, this is the county attorney's argument, should follow the guidelines set forth in the tribal state agreement, DHS manual, and the rules of juvenile protection procedure, finding transfer after termination of parental rights is not prohibited under ICWA.
So, Ms. Van Norman, the guardian ad litem appealed the case, is that right?
That's right, and you don't see DHS up here today.
All right. Are there any further questions or discussion relating to this bill?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I heard your account of that one particular case, but is that typical of what happens in these cases? It seems like the county attorneys have a different perspective, and now we in the legislature are now faced with the decision of what to do.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I understand that. The County Attorneys Association clearly has changed its approach to everything from the agreement to this particular case and this particular scenario. The thing that we're asking you to do here is to recognize we already have provisions in the law to deal with too late transfers. A case, the exceptional case where, say, a tribe maybe learns late of a case or decides to step in late for whatever reason, and I don't speak for all in 565 federally recognized Indian tribes in the United States. These are different sovereign entities with their own laws. But what we have already is a provision that does not distinguish based upon types of cases, whether it's a pre-adoptive proceeding or another kind of proceeding. We have this provision you've already heard something about, good cause for a transfer or to deny a transfer. That good cause analysis is what's there and what protects everybody from a too late stage transfer or an inappropriate transfer. Again, the state tribal agreement goes a long way to flesh that out, and again, that's something that's thoroughgoing in federal ICWA law and in our state Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. It states in the tribal state agreement where there may be good cause to deny a transfer where a petition is inexcusably filed when the proceeding is already at an advanced stage. Contrast that with the scenario we actually have in this case and in many cases where it's very excusably filed. In fact, it's by basic agreement of all of the parties in interest that it's filed when it is. There are practicalities we should leave to the tribal courts and the state courts and the players in particular cases.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
Ms. Van Norman, I don't expect you to know how all 500 plus tribes throughout the United States handle this. I think we have 11 that we
Correct.
Need to focus on. And my concern is, and I don't know if we've learned this, but how much time is in play when an Indian tribe should know, pre-adoptive wise, that there's a child that is looking for a home? And if we have that party that isn't reacting or responding, and yet we have a system that's looking for an adoption placement, how much time is needed? How much time normally takes place? Is it a year or 6 months? Is it a couple days? And that's why tribal communities want to have at least a last grab on this, or is it? And I don't even know if that's an appropriate way to characterize it, but how much time does it take to place a child, and is that a reasonable amount of time? And I understand that as a child starts to get associated with a potential family, there are bonds that are being made, and not just for the child, but for a potential parent as well. And we certainly have heard the bureaucratic stories. Take away the Indian tribal reference, but just kids in general. Placement starts, abused home is where the child comes from, and at the very last second, someone comes in and demands that the child stay. And yet there's bonds, there's relationships, there's expectations, there's other children and families that think they're going to get a new brother or sister, and now that's gone. What's the proper place so that those bonds aren't built so severely that it causes emotional harm? And at the same time, if there is a placement that's originally suited, when is there a final day when that separates? I think that's what we're trying to struggle with.
Ms. Van Norman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lemmer, I understand your question. It actually gets to an entirely different part of the ICWA. The ICWA also has tribally mandated or tribal placement preferences that apply whether or not a case is in state court or is potentially subject to transfer later. It doesn't matter. A tribal placement preference places at the top for either foster care or permanent placement purposes, a tribally approved family, a kin family, a member of the family. And then there are placement preferences that go from there. That is supposed to happen right away. A tribe is supposed to get noticed within, I believe it's 20 days of an initial, say, an emergency removal of a child from their home. That doesn't always happen. Sometimes that's why we end up in a late intervention scenario, but that's the standard. So that can help drive when and how a tribe is participating. Economic resources can drive how and when a tribe is participating. If a tribe is distant from a proceeding and it's uncertain what will happen, and a family lives in the metropolitan area, let's say, then it might be by agreement, as you saw in this context, in the RS and LS case context, that a tribe doesn't get involved at a higher degree right away. So that's a more subjective thing, and that's kind of the emphasis that we're saying. It would be great if we had the certainty that we're seeking, but in fact, we think that it's much better to allow that good cause standard to remain and drive decision-making on this, rather than try to say, well, this kind of proceeding, not that kind of proceeding, because frankly, you could get to the pre-adoptive stage very quickly if you had voluntary agreements, voluntary termination, let's say.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lemon.
Ms. Harris, maybe you could answer my question. How long does it take to place a child? Give me a reference of time that we're talking about.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Harris.
Committee. When you say place a child, do you mean originally place or permanently place?
Permanent placement.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the standard in Minnesota is that, or the best practice is that we find a home right away that not only is a foster care placement but also a permanency option.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
How long of an advance time does a tribal community have in reference to this type of a placement?
Mr. Chair.
Harris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as soon as the child is placed and there's any indication the child is affiliated with a tribe or one of the parents are eligible for membership or the child in any way might be defined as an Indian child, there are efforts immediately to locate the tribe if we know which tribe it is and make contact or to make contact with the Bureau of Indian Affairs to find out which tribe. So as soon as there's a placement, we're reaching out to the tribe.
And
Senator Limmer, and then we're going to have to wrap things up.
Yeah. I think I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
You know, I'm willing to. I don't know if people are ready, but I'm willing to entertain or put forward a motion to move Senate File 250 forward, and it's would go where, Senator Latz?
To the floor.
To the floor.
All right, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 250 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. Is there any further discussion on this motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair, members.
Members, if you would please, information relating to Senate Files 490 and 668 in your packets, please leave them there so we don't have to. So they're already ready to go tonight. We are going to recess until 6 o'clock, and we will reconvene in this room, Capitol 15, at 6 p.m. So we are in recess.
This is the one that – are you on finance?
Yeah.
Good. You'll be able to fix that down, right?